212-209-2950. 28 minutes after the hour. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. Our fall membership and fundraising drive continues. I am Hugh Hamilton with Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of incidental music. This afternoon, we are featuring the work of Professor Michelle Alexander. And we're offering you, as a thank you gift this afternoon, at the $60 pledge level, we're sending you a copy of her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. It was a rousing, compelling, highly informative and inspirational, wonderfully and beautifully motivational talk delivered by Professor Michelle Alexander, discussing her New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. We also have the revised and updated edition of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. That book is also available with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the lecture. The lecture is available on DVD. You can get both the book and the talk with your pledge at the $100 level. We're looking now for your calls to fill the board. We're looking now for an additional 11 of your calls right now. 212-209-2950. The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Do you know, I want to read you a bit from this book while you get to the phones and call 212-209-2950. I want to read for you from a section in which Michelle Alexander writes about how this system, how this new Jim Crow works, and how it disproportionately targets particularly young men of color. Michelle Alexander, she writes, precisely how the system of mass incarceration works to trap African Americans in a virtual and literal cage can best be understood by viewing the system as a whole. Only when we view the cage from a distance can we disengage from the maze of rationalizations that are offered for each wire and see how the entire apparatus operates to keep African Americans perpetually trapped. This, in brief, is how the system works. The war on drugs is the vehicle through which extraordinary numbers of black men are forced into the cage. The entrapment occurs in three distinct phases, each of which has been explored earlier, but a brief review is useful here. The first stage is the roundup. Vast numbers of people are swept into the criminal justice system by the police, who conduct drug operations primarily in poor communities of color. They are rewarded in cash through drug forfeiture laws and federal grant programs for rounding up as many people as possible, and they operate unconstrained by constitutional rules of procedure that once were considered inviolate. Police can stop, interrogate, and search anyone they choose for drug investigations, provided they get so-called consent. Because there is no meaningful check on the exercise of police discretion, racial biases are granted free rein. In fact, police are allowed to rely on race as a factor in selecting whom to stop and search, even though people of color are no more likely to be guilty of drug crimes than whites, effectively guaranteeing that those who are swept into the system are primarily black and brown. The conviction marks the beginning of the second phase, the period of formal control. Once arrested, defendants are generally denied meaningful legal representation and pressured to plead guilty, whether they are or not. Prosecutors are free to load up defendants with extra charges, and their decisions cannot be challenged for racial bias. Once convicted, due to the drug war's harsh sentencing laws, drug offenders in the United States spend more time under the criminal justice system's formal control, in jail or prison, on probation or parole, than drug offenders anywhere else in the world. While under formal control, virtually every aspect of one's life is regulated and monitored by the system, and any form of resistance or disobedience is subject to swift sanction. This period of control may last a lifetime, even for those convicted of extremely minor non-violent offenses, but the vast majority of those swept up into the system are eventually released. They are transferred from their prison cells to a much larger invisible cage. And here now, she writes about the final stage. Now, I want you to pay particular attention to this this period that Professor Alexander calls the final stage, because this is the aspect of this problem of mass incarceration that very often that most of us do not recognize or acknowledge. And please continue to call 212-209-2950 while I'm sharing this information with you. This is a phase of the operation. You know, it's we talk about people who are in prison or in jail, or people who are on parole, or people who are on probation. We talk about the fact that there are 6 million people in this country who are in under some form of correctional supervision. But what happens to those people once they are released, once they are no longer in jail or prison, once they are no longer on probation or on parole? I think that this is where Professor Michelle Alexander really makes one of her most compelling arguments, an argument that is most often overlooked. And this argument alone is worth the price of admission. So please continue to call 212-209-2950. Remember, you get the book, the revised and updated edition of The New Jim Crow, the New York Times bestseller, as a standalone item with your pledge at the $60 level. You can also get her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church on DVD. That's also available as a $60 pledge level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD with your pleasure at the $100 level. Now, the number to call, 212-209-2950. Professor Alexander then goes on to write in her book about the final stage, which has been dubbed by some advocates the period of invisible punishment. Think about that for a moment. The period of invisible punishment. This term, first coined by Jeremy Travis, is meant to describe the unique set of criminal sanctions that are imposed on individuals after they step outside the prison gates, a form of punishment that operates largely outside of public view and takes effect outside the traditional sentencing framework. These sanctions are imposed by operation of law rather than decisions of a sentencing judge, yet they often have a greater impact on one's life course than the months or years one actually spends behind bars. Think about that for a moment. These laws operate collectively to ensure that the vast majority of convicted offenders will never integrate into mainstream white society. They will be discriminated against legally for the rest of their lives, denied unemployment, housing, education, and public benefits. Unable to surmount these obstacles, most will eventually return to prison and then be released again, caught in a closed circuit of perpetual marginality. In recent years, she writes, advocates and politicians have called for greater resources devoted to the problem of prisoner reentry in view of the unprecedented numbers of people who are released from prison and return to their communities every year. While the terminology is well-intentioned, it utterly fails to convey the gravity of the situation facing prisoners upon their release. People who have been convicted of felonies almost never truly re-enter the society they inhabited prior to their conviction. I want to read that sentence again for you. People who have been convicted of felonies almost never truly re-enter the society they inhabited prior to their conviction. Instead, they enter a separate society, a world hidden from public view, governed by a set of oppressive and discriminatory rules and laws that do not apply to everyone else. They become members of an undercaste, an enormous population of predominantly black and brown people who, because of the drug war, are denied basic rights and privileges of American citizenship and are permanently relegated to an inferior status. This is the final phase, and there is no going back. This from Professor Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I'm reading here from the revised and updated edition of the book. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not believe that I need go any further in order to ask, to encourage, to exhort you to go to the phones and to make that call, to make that pledge of support. Because you and I both know there is no other radio station that is going to share this information, that is going to present this lecture by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, or that is going to share and offer this book. This book is a game changer. This book has changed both the tone and the content and the quality of the public conversation on issues of mass incarceration in this country. This book has revolutionized our collective understanding. As you know, once in a while, a book comes along that changes the way we see the world and helps to fuel a nationwide social movement. And this book, The New Jim Crow, is such a book. This revised and updated edition with a new foreword by Professor Cornel West is available as a thank you gift to you with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get Michelle Alexander's talk on the new Jim Crow at the Abyssinian Baptist Church at the $60 pledge level. Or you can get them both the book and the DVD with her talk as a thank you gift with your $100 tax deductible contribution to WBAI. Now, I should not have to belabor this point. If you already have this, then you can get another copy for someone else, perhaps. And if you have not yet made a pledge of support, this is the time to do it. This is the moment to do so. And as I mentioned earlier, in case you missed it, after today, I'm not going to be back here again for another week because I'm taking some time off. This is a part of my annual vacation. So I'm taking about a week or so off. So you and I are not going to be doing this again until either Thursday of next week or the following Monday. Either Thursday 25th or Monday 29th. Either of those days. So, you're going to be, there are going to be others who will, of course, be presenting fantastic programs in my absence in this time slot, but I'd like to be able to walk out of here this afternoon knowing that we have done well and that this afternoon's edition of the program, this fundraising edition of Talkback, has been highly successful, and that can happen only with the benefit of your support. So I'm asking you to go to the phones right now and to make that call at whatever level is convenient and comfortable for you. 212-209-2950. I'm going to rely on the honor system here and hope that you will call while the presentation is in progress. You always come through for us, and so I know you will again, but you don't have to make it a nail biter. 212-209-2950. Thank you very much to those who are on the line right now. Please continue to call while the presentation is in progress as we return to more of Professor Michelle Alexander discussing the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of color blindness.
Protections against unreasonable searches and seizures no longer applies to that encounter. Now, the Supreme Court knows that very few people dare to refuse consent when a police officer says, "May I search you? May I speak with you for a moment?" But even when someone does refuse consent, it'll be their word against a police officer's in a court of law. And who is the judge more likely to believe? In this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted the police license to sweep communities, stopping, frisking, tossing people. Extraordinarily high numbers of folks. Here in New York City, there were 614,000 stops and frisks in 2010. More than 600,000 stops and frisks in 1 year. 87% were Black and Latino. There were 50,000 people arrested for simple marijuana possession. 50,000 people acquired criminal records for having a little weed in their pocket that would have never been found if they were on a college campus or in a middle-class white community in a suburban neighborhood. 87% Black and Latino. But the U.S. Supreme Court has gone one step further. It has ruled that you can no longer challenge race discrimination by law enforcement. You can no longer challenge racial bias in the criminal justice system unless you have evidence of conscious, intentional bias tantamount to an admission. In a series of cases beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp and Armstrong versus the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it doesn't matter how severe the racial disparities are. It doesn't matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence might be. Unless you can produce some conscious intentional bias like an admission by an officer, you can't even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system today. Well, this may not come as news to you, but most officers do not say, "Yes, Your Honor, the reason I stopped him was, well, because he was Black." Most prosecutors don't say, "Well, Your Honor, I would have given him a better plea deal, but he was Black." No, most law enforcement officials, like the rest of us, know better than to state their racial biases out loud. But more importantly, so many of the racial biases and stereotypes that motivate discretionary decision-making by law enforcement operate on such an unconscious level that many law enforcement folks wouldn't even be able to articulate it if they tried. You know, an officer who thinks he's doing his job, driving down the street, sees group of Black kids walking down the street with pants sagging a bit, and he thinks, "Let me jump out, check on them, see what they're up to. Let me frisk them and see," you know. Thinking they're doing their job, doing good. The same thought would never cross their mind. See a group of young white kids walking down the street in their neighborhood. That officer may not be meaning any harm to those young Black kids walking down the street. But those unconscious biases and stereotypes play out over and over again in hundreds of thousands of stops and frisks every year, adding up to enormous racial disparities in our system, which the Supreme Court has ruled we can't even challenge in a court of law. And in this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has immunized the system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias, much in the same way that it rallied to the defense of Jim Crow and slavery in their day. Now, I know our time is running short, and I want to leave plenty of time for question and answer, but I just have to identify some of the most obvious parallels between Jim Crow and mass incarceration and say a few words about what we're going to do to end this. You know, Jim Crow was a system of rules, laws, policies, and practices that operated to lock African Americans into a permanent second-class status. I have to say that explicitly because I found in speaking to high school students, many of them don't know that. They don't even know what Jim Crow is. They say, "New Jim Crow? What's Jim Crow?" And with such extraordinary dropout rates today, realize there is a lot of education about our history that needs to happen before we can even have a conversation about the new Jim Crow. But today, You take look at some of the rules and laws that apply to people branded criminals and felons today, and ask yourself if they remind you of a bygone era. The first and most obvious, of course, is denial of the right to vote. 48 states in the District of Columbia deny prisoners the right to vote, and here in the United States, I find people to kind of meet that with a shrug of their shoulders. We're like, well, yeah, they're prisoners. Why should they be able to vote? Well, in many other Western democracies, prisoners have the right to vote. In fact, in some of them, there's voting drives in prison. But here in the United States, we not only deny the vote to people who are in prison, but we strip them of the right to vote in many states for a period of years or sometimes for the rest of their lives. Nationwide, nearly 1 in 7 black men are either temporarily or permanently disenfranchised as a result of felon disenfranchisement laws. Then there's exclusion from jury service. One hallmark of the old Jim Crow was the systematic exclusion of blacks from juries. Well, today, those labeled felons are deemed ineligible for jury service for the rest of their lives. In many areas, all white juries are having a roaring comeback because so many African Americans are deemed ineligible for jury service. Employment discrimination. Virtually every job application has that box you gotta check, asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Doesn't matter if that felony happened a few months ago or 45 years ago, for the rest of your life, gotta check that box, knowing full well the odds are sky high, your application's going straight to the trash. Hundreds of professional licenses are off limits to people who've been labeled felons. In fact, in my state, in Ohio, you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. Housing discrimination is perfectly legal, absolutely routine. Public housing projects, as well as private landlords, free to discriminate on the basis of criminal records. In fact, if a young man is released from prison and wants to return home to his children, his partner, and they live in public housing, his whole family risks eviction if they allow him to come home and the family to be reunified again. Discrimination in public benefits, perfectly legal. As I mentioned, if you're a drug felon, you're deemed ineligible for food stamps under federal law for the rest of your life. Fortunately, many states have now opted out of the federal ban on food stamps for drug offenders. But still, thousands of people can't even get food because they were once caught with some drugs. So what are people supposed to do returning home from prison? Can't get a job, nowhere to sleep. You may not even be able to get food stamps to feed yourself. Well, apparently what we expect them to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support, which continues to accrue while you're in prison. In a growing number of states, you're expected to pay back the cost of your imprisonment. And then get this. If you're actually one of the lucky few who manages to get a job, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. 100 to pay back all those fees, fines, court costs, and accumulated back child support. What are folks expected to do? I say, what is this system designed to do? It sure seems designed to send folks right back to prison, which is what in fact happens. That's exactly what happens about 70% of the time. About 70% of people released from prison return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return, according to some studies, do so in a matter of months because the challenges associated with mere survival on the outside are so immense. Still, many people returning home from prison tell me that's not even the worst of it. It's not even the worst of it. It's the shame and stigma that follows you for the rest of your life that haunts you. It's not just the denial of the job, but that look that flashes over the employer's face when he sees, that box has been checked. It's not just the denial of housing, but the shame of having to beg your aunt, your grandma, to sleep in their basement at night. There's nowhere else to take you in. It's that shame and stigma that causes so many people branded criminals and felons to try to pass. You know, during the old Jim Crow, light-skinned blacks would try to pass as white to avoid the shame and stigma of race. Well, today, people branded criminals and felons try to pass by failing to check the box on employment applications or on housing forms, but more importantly, by lying and denying and avoiding with family members, friends, relatives. So an excellent ethnographic study conducted in Washington, D.C. was published as a book called Doing Time on the Outside. It was a study of neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. hardest hit by mass incarceration. I mean, these are neighborhoods where literally every house or every other apartment has a family member who's either behind bars or has just been released from prison. I mean, neighborhoods where incarceration is so common, you'd think people just be talking about it all the time. Who's in? Who's out? And to some extent, that was true. But in this study, they were unable to find one person, one, who had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, loved ones about their own criminal history or that of their relatives. Children, when asked by a relative, "Honey, where's your daddy? Where's your daddy been?" Child would say, "My daddy, I don't know where my daddy is." Knowing full well, daddy's in prison. People run into a neighbor on the street. Neighbor says, "Oh, I haven't seen you in years. Where have you been? It's been so long. It's so good to see you. How you doing? Where have you been?" "Oh, you know, I've been out of town. It's good to see you. Yeah, I gotta go." That shame and stigma keeps even the community's hardest hit silent in denial, avoiding, shaming, and blaming one another. And this silence and denial makes collective political action next to impossible. So what do? Where do we go from here? Well, I spend the last chapter of my book discussing this in some depth, but one thing is clear, I think. Those of us in the civil rights community, we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. We have. We have. While many of us, myself included, fighting for affirmative action, fighting to cling to the gains of the past, millions of people rounded up, branded criminals and felons, stripped of the very rights people gave their lives for. So what do? Over the last few decades, $1 trillion has been spent waging the drug war. A trillion with a T. Funds that could have been used for education in our communities, for job creation. Funds that could have been used for our collective well-being. Instead, those dollars have been used for the destruction of so many of our families, our communities, our dreams. What do? My own view is that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. Any hope. And if you think something less will do, if you think piecemeal policy reform is enough, or if you think we can tinker with this machine and then get it right, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement kicked off, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. This system is now so deeply rooted in our political, economic structure that it isn't just going to fade away. It's not going to just fade away without a major social upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. So how do do this? How do we build this movement? Well, first, I think we've got to begin by telling the truth, the whole truth. We have got to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have managed to rebirth a caste-like system in the United States. And we've got to be willing to tell this truth in our churches, in our schools, in our community centers. Because if we fail to wake up, really wake up, we will never build the kind of movement that is necessary to end this system. But even that is not enough. Consciousness raising is not enough. We've also got to be willing to build an underground railroad for the people returning home from prison. Yes. People who are struggling, striving to make a true break for freedom have got to be supported, have got to be welcomed with open arms, with love. So many people who have been released from prison tell me often that church is one place they don't feel safe to go. It's a place where they often feel intense shame and stigma. Mothers of sons who are behind bars say, well, I used to go to church, but I don't go anymore. The truth is, we're all criminals. We all are. All of us. You know, people tell me, I'm not a criminal. Don't call me a criminal. I'm not a criminal. And I say, well, maybe you drank underage. Maybe you experimented with drugs. Or if the worst thing you've done in your unadventurous life is speed 10 miles over the speed limit on the freeway, you've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room. So, here in the United States, there are people doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses. Life sentences. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld life sentences for first-time drug offenses in a case called Harmland versus Michigan. They upheld it against a challenge that such a punishment was cruel and unusual in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it's not cruel and unusual to sentence a young man to death behind bars for a first-time drug offense, even though no other country in the world does such a thing. So we've got to stop this us versus them. The criminals are someone who's not us. And instead say, there but for the grace of God, go I. All of us. All of us are sinners. All of us have made mistakes, have done wrong. And all of us need to be given second and third and fourth chances, because none of us have made only one mistake in our lives. So we have to open our hearts.
This is WBAI New York, where it is now 5 o'clock. Usually at this time we'd be listening to the opening strains of the 5 o'clock shadow, but we are here for an additional hour this afternoon, and we've been sharing with you thus far today on this Tuesday, October 16th fundraising edition of the program Talk Back. We've been sharing with you extended excerpts from Professor Michelle Alexander's compelling lecture delivered at the Abyssinian Baptist Church this year, a lecture on her new book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I say new book even though the book is not entirely new. It's a recent book, but we also have, the book has just been an updated and revised edition of the book. It's just out, recently out in paperback. And we have that as a thank you gift for you with your pledge at the $60 pledge level this afternoon. So when you call us this afternoon with a pledge of $60, that's a tax deductible contribution of $60 to listener sponsored commercial free WBAI this afternoon, we will send you a copy of this new updated and revised edition of Michelle Alexander's New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. This talk, delivered at Abyssinian Baptist Church on the subject of the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness, is also available as a thank you gift as a standalone item. It's on DVD as a thank you gift. It's available with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD with a pledge of $100 to WBAI. I'm asking you now, in this final hour of the program, to get to the telephones and to join those who are on the line at the moment. Let's see how many people are on the line at the moment. Let's 212-209-2950 is the number. We can take another 9 of you to fill the board. Another 9 of your calls right now. 212-209-2950 in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Wherever you're listening to us, in Minnesota, in Missouri or Missouri. If you're listening to us in California, you're listening to us in Mississippi, in Alabama. You know, last night at this really fantastic event, we had an evening with Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is just back from Alabama. And he was telling me, and he later disclosed during the course of his presentation, that in Alabama, 34% of African American men are ineligible to vote because of a previous criminal conviction. Now, this is by any measure, by any standard, not only appalling, but it is shocking, and it is a tragedy. When you think that one third of eligible voters of any single group, in this case it happens to be African American males in Alabama, are ineligible to vote because of a previous criminal conviction. When you listen to Michelle Alexander explain how these criminal convictions have come to pass, how they have come into being, not because these people are more likely or have some greater more likely to commit criminal acts or have some greater propensity for criminal behavior, but because of the way in which we have redefined what crime is, and because of the selective enforcement of that redefined concept of what crime is, because of the abandonment of constitutional protections like your Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure, and because of the way this system of institutionalized racial discrimination, this new Jim Crow, has taken hold in the society and has taken on a life of its own and becomes now a self-perpetuating reality that keeps drawing into its maw and ever larger numbers of young African American males and other young people of color. Now the number is 212-209-2950. This is a book that has redefined our public conversation on the criminal justice system. It has redefined our understanding and our vocabulary even on the matter of race and the criminal justice system. It has helped us, I think, at all levels to approach this subject with new insights, with new understanding, and with a much different level of appreciation for the complexities involved. And this lecture, we were only able to share with you some of it, but we'll send you the lecture in its entirety. If you've been trying to get through to us and you were unable to do so a moment ago because all the lines were taken and all the volunteers were busy, well, this is a great time to call because half a dozen lines are now available. And this is a very quick process. It takes about maybe 2.5-3 minutes at most. 212-209-2950. Please make a pledge of support at a level that is comfortable and convenient for you. 212-209-2950. Now, what I'm trying to figure out here now is whether should we go back to more of Michelle Alexander, or should I now go to an excerpt? I'm thinking that what I want to do, this lecture by Michelle Alexander continues to be available throughout the afternoon, 212-209-2950. But listening to her reminded me so much, and I was discussing this with Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music, reminded me so much of an earlier lecture that had titled, "And How Are the Children?" This is a lecture dealing with the that also dealt with the problem of mass incarceration, and it also dealt with the disproportionate impact of that mass incarceration on African-American families. But it dealt with it from the point of view of the children, and the fact that such younger and younger people were being caught up in the system of mass incarceration. That lecture, "How Are the Children?" was delivered by Dr. Joy DeGruy. Dr. DeGruy, as you know, is the originator of the theory of post-traumatic slave syndrome. And that lecture was delivered in Newark, New Jersey. It was probably one of the high points in her public in her career of public presentations. I want to share some of that with you this afternoon. It's been a while since we did Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture, "How Are the Children?", in which she deals with the impact of mass incarceration on black families in the United States. And she explores, and this is a double CD set. This is a CD set that includes not only her lecture, which goes on for well over an hour, but it also includes a question and answer session. And this was recorded in Newark, New Jersey. So I want to share some of that with you, and we'll send you Dr. DeGruy's lecture as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $50 level. So your $60 pledge gets you either The New Jim Crow, the book, or the lecture by Michelle Alexander, or your $100 pledge gets you Michelle Alexander's book and DVD. Your $50 pledge gets you the double CD set of Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture, "How Are the Children?" I want to share some of that with you. So all of this continues to be available throughout the afternoon. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, the book and the lecture available together, a $100 pledge. Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture available for the first time, this double CD set, available for the first time at the $50 pledge level. So if in previous offerings you were unable to take advantage of the opportunity, then, you can do so now. It's this lecture by Dr. Joy DeGruy. It's a workshop, really. It's a lecture and workshop. It's titled "How Are the Children?", and it's available on a double audio CD set with your pledge at the $50 level, 212-209-2950. I want to do some of that in this final hour of today's edition of Talkback. So I'd like you, however, to continue to call 212-209-2950. Thank you so much for your support. It's been a while since we featured anything by Dr. Joy DeGruy. So we're going to do that now, and remember that Michelle Alexander's book and lecture continue to be available. The book, either one as a standalone item at the $60 pledge level, the book and the DVD together at the $100 level, and Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture, from which we're about to share an excerpt now, that lecture and workshop, "How Are the Children?", that's available on a double audio CD set with your pledge at the $50 level, 212-209-2950. Let's listen to some of Dr. Joy DeGruy from her lecture, delivered in Newark, New Jersey. This one titled, "And How Are the Children?"
When I talk about post-traumatic slave syndrome, the more I look, and I don't know if any of you have seen the recent PBS special, "Slavery and the Making of America." How many people saw that? It's not unclear to any of us now whether people believe the theory that I have submitted. No matter how you look at it, we understand that America's wealth, America's prosperity has been on the backs of African people. And believe me, the greatest fear is not that we will heal. That is not the greatest fear. They would love for us to all stand and sing "We Are the World" together. And the greatest fear is that we will seek recompense. I don't know what kind of recompense, though, can be sought when you have stolen a people's soul and their dignity. But I want to talk a little bit about the impact of what has occurred as it relates to slavery directly. One of the things we understand that's associated with adulthood, with parenting, is the care of children. How many of you are familiar with something called secure attachment? Okay, secure attachment has to do with children that feel comfortable enough and safe enough in their environment that they're able to stray and explore, that they do not feel frightened or insecure to such a degree that they are unable to grow and develop. These are children that cry and scream and are unable to function because they do not have that fundamental secure attachment. What we also know is that secure attachment begins from birth. It begins from birth with the mother and that bond that happens. But even now we know it happens even before birth. What we've discovered most recently is there's something called a stress hormone that can pass from the mother through the placenta to the child. It's called a stress hormone. They never understood the relationship of a mother under stress and the impact on the growing child. So truly, the stress began even before the child was born. The stress hormone was passed. So if we begin to look at that from the beginning, a mother that finds herself pregnant, whether it is the master's child, whether or not it is the man she has chosen or her husband, or those other Africans in her environment that raped her, all of which occurred, there was a stress that the mother felt. So I want to begin at the beginning, the stress that the mother felt. One, in actually conceiving that child, and then the stress related to, even before the child was born, whether or not she should adequately bond or attach to that child. Are you following me? So now when the child is born, how much must she love this child? How much must she give of herself to this child that may, at any moment in the middle of the night or upon being born, be taken from her? Human beings had to learn to adjust to that reality, but what it produced was a fractioning of family, a fractioning of human beings, a misguided connection between one's family, children, spouse. So what began early was the stress that was passed along through the placenta to the child, the mother who gives birth to the child and does not know whether or not she should secure her attachment to that child. And we also know that associated with children who do not bond immediately, for example, preemies, one of the things they'll do with children that are premature is they'll tell the mothers to come in, even if the child is hooked up to machines, to hold that child, to nurse that child. So important is that bond. When that bond does not occur early on, there are disabilities that are encountered in the actual personality and development of that child. So one of the things that slaves did is they figured out this kind of community, this kind of family, where any child that came in was loved. So that's actually how these children began to learn to bond. But it wasn't with the primary caretaker often. But they understood, everyone understood, that however long you're with us, we have to love you. And so these children were loved. But imagine what was happening to the mother. How could she sleep when every morning she wondered if the child would be there the next day? How did she work in the fields when she wondered when she came back if that child would be there that she birthed? So this is a condition under which children were born. So now let's look at what happens to a child that is subjected to trauma early on. Now you all have heard about, you know, we talk about trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. We understand that there are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, hypervigilance, exaggerated startle response, outbursts of anger, difficulty sleeping, difficulty waking, change in habits, feelings of foreshortened future, feelings of doom, doesn't feel like one will live long or have a family. These are the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is spoken of in adult terms. But what happens to the child? That is what happens to an adult when we consider post-traumatic stress disorder. Often that's what we think of, what happens to the adult. But what happens to a child early on that is subjected to trauma? What happens to the child from 0 to 5 that is subjected to trauma? There is something that human beings do when they are attacked or when they feel that their lives are in any way threatened. It's a natural response. It's called fight or flight. It is part of what we've done to survive as a human reality. So what happens to children when they're exposed to traumas early on is what gets developed in them is an excessive amount of cortisol in the brain. We're talking about hardwiring now. Stay with me, because these are some of the things that we're seeing happening in our community with our children today. So what happens when there's cortisol released in the brain is it creates the feeling and the sense of fight or flight. So, for example, if I am standing out on the curb outside and I notice that there's a semi-truck approaching me, what ends up happening when that semi-truck approaches me is my brain shuts off my capacity for reason. It shuts off my capacity for reason. In other words, my brain stops my ability to be rational. In other words, I don't want to stop and go, well, you know, I'm noticing that there's a semi coming. Perhaps I should move. I don't know, maybe to the right, to the left. No, what my brain does is shuts out my capacity to do that. And what happens in a flash, I find myself moved over to the other side of the street. Someone approaches and says, Joy, what happened? I go, I can't remember. All I remember is the truck coming, and I don't actually physically remember moving. Because what happens is my brain no longer gave me access to reason. Are you following me? So what happens to a person in fight or flight is they're not being reasonable or rational anymore. Okay, so now when a child is constantly exposed to trauma, they have an excessive amount of that chemical cortisol, which produces a fight or flight. So here's what you find, and here's what it looks like. You walk up to, right now, elementary, middle school kid, even preschoolers, and you say, Shaniqua, honey, I need you to pick up your books. Why are you always on me? How come I gotta pick up the books? Why aren't you chilling? You didn't say nothing. You make me sick. And you go, well, my God, what just happened? Because what happened to Shaniqua is she didn't hear me, what was all she could see in her life and what she experiences. Fight or flight. Which one is this? And what did she interpret that was? It was a fight. It was a fight. So now here's what happens in our schools that are trying to educate our children. And what happened to the slave children is, of course, an adult says, now listen, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you better pick up. Well, no, don't you. You better back up. And all of a sudden, chairs are getting thrown and books and stuff, because all it's going to do is escalate. Because is Shaniqua able to reason? Absolutely not. So the more you talk to her, the more she escalates, right? This happens with our children. You've seen it, haven't you? You wonder what just happened, right? Fight or flight. So what must you do? I understand what to do, because now I understand that I'm not looking at a kid that's accessing reason. So the first thing I'm going to do is model what I need them to do. I'm going to stop. I'm going to lower my voice. I'm going to speak slowly. I'm going to say, Shaniqua, baby, I want you to know I wasn't attacking you, okay? And what I need you to do, what I wanted you to do, was to pick up your books. Now I want to give you some time, okay? So you can take care of yourself, but I need you to know I love you. I wasn't trying to hurt you, okay? And I give her a chance to calm down so she can access what? Reason. So what happens to children consistently that are in a situation where they're experiencing trauma is fight or flight. And that is what we are seeing over and over again in these schools. We're seeing it over and over and again with parents who don't understand that while they're coping with whatever stresses and trauma they're dealing with, their children are coping too. Only now, it's almost like a drug. It becomes so normalized that they will actually trigger it when they're uncomfortable. They will trigger the cortisol because that becomes a normal feeling. You've met people that live in crisis, right? And when there isn't one, what do? They create a crisis because this becomes a habitual behavior.
WBAI, New York. It is 21 minutes after the hour, and we're just pausing here to give you an opportunity to join those who are on the line at the moment to make a call, to call 212-209-2950. We're listening here to an excerpt from Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture, How Are the Children? Now, over the course of the afternoon thus far, we have presented Michelle Alexander's talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, discussing her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. We have the book, the new updated revised edition of Professor Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. We have that as a thank you gift to you. And as a standalone item, it's available as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $60 level. We also have her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. That too, as a standalone item, is available as a thank you gift to you with your pledge at the $60 level. And remember that your pledge is a tax-deductible contribution to listener-sponsored commercial-free WBAI New York. But then I thought that there was so much of what Professor Alexander delivered in the course of her talk was so much of it was so evocative of some of the experience and argument and thesis and presentation made earlier by Dr. Joy DeGruy that I thought it would be a great experience to juxtapose these two these two eminent experts in their respective fields. Dr. DeGruy, as you know, is both an expert in mental health and in social work, and she is the originator of the theory of post-traumatic slave syndrome. And Michelle Alexander is a professor of law at Ohio State University, where she holds a joint appointment at the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. She's formerly director of the ACLU's Racial Justice Project in Northern California, and she is an eminent and nationally renowned civil rights attorney. The new foreword to the revised and updated edition of her book is written by Professor Cornel West. Here's some of what Cornel West says about Michelle Alexander's book. Cornel West writes, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow is the secular Bible for a new social movement in early 21st century America. How do you like that for starters? Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow is the secular Bible for a new social movement in early 21st century America. That's how Cornel West begins his new foreword to the revised and updated edition of Michelle Alexander's book. He continues by noting that while the age of Obama is a time of historic breakthroughs at the level of racial symbols and political surfaces, Michelle Alexander's magisterial work takes us beyond those breakthroughs to the systemic breakdowns of black and poor communities devastated by mass unemployment, social neglect, economic abandonment, and intense police surveillance. Her subtle analysis shifts our attention from the racial symbol of America's achievement to the actual substance of America's shame, the massive use of state power to incarcerate hundreds of thousands of precious, poor, black, male, and increasingly female young people in the name of a bogus war on drugs. And her nuanced historical narrative tracing the unconscionable treatment and brutal control of black people, slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration takes us beneath the political surface and lays bare the structures of a racial caste system alive and well in the age of colorblindness. That from the foreword by Professor Cornel West to Michelle Alexander's new and updated edition of her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The book is available as a thank you gift with your pleasure at the $50 level. Her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church also available that as a thank you gift at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the talk by Michelle Alexander with a pledge, a tax deductible contribution to WBAI at the $100 level. Also this afternoon, we are very pleased to offer to you, it's been a while since we did, we are very pleased to offer to you Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture on a double audio CD set. It's titled, How Are the Children? This is a work that preceded Michelle Alexander's work, and I thought that so much of what Michelle Alexander is discussing in her book and in her talk is so much of it is so evocative of so many of the hypotheses that are explored in Dr. DeGruy's work, and so many of the theses that Dr. DeGruy has advanced over the years, including but not limited to her thesis on post-traumatic slave syndrome and her personal investigation into the impact of mass incarceration on the lives of increasingly younger and younger African American children and young people and young adults. This is a very provocative work by Dr. Joy DeGruy. It's available as a thank you gift on a double audio CD set with your pledge at the $50 level. That's a $50 pledge to WBAI. The number to call, 212-209-2950. It is now 28 minutes after the hour. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour. We need another 35, another 40. We need about 40 calls in the next 30 minutes or so. 212-209-2950. We need about 40 of your calls at whatever level it is comfortable and convenient for you to pledge to WBAI. 40 of your calls. We need those calls. 212-209-2950. And we thank you very much for your support. We'll return now to more of Dr. Joy DeGruy's talk. Remember, her talk is part of a much larger event that took place in Newark, New Jersey. It was a talk and a workshop. So this is why it is on a double audio CD set. The talk itself is well over an hour. The lecture, and there's also another hour and change of participant involvement, question and answer session, that sort of thing. 212-209-2950. We're coming up to 30 minutes after the hour. This is WBAI New York, and we thank you very much for your support.
The problem is, we haven't even, and we're just talking about neurophysiology there, that's the brain. We're talking about very early that children begin to develop that, and they trigger it, and it becomes a pattern of behavior in their lives, so much so that their lives become uncontrollable, which becomes normalcy. But understand that these are the things that are that have both an environmental behavioral effect, a neurophysiology related to the body in terms of the way you respond, a cultural introduction to such a degree that we begin to normalize violence. And, you know, people get, there's an agitation, an expectation of crises within our communities. We rush to it. We all of a sudden, there's a frenzy around it because it's becoming habitual, and it's becoming to such a degree that we are being crippled by it. But no one knew what it was, you see. We've never evaluated it to try to understand, why is that so? Why is it such a frenzy around fighting? Why is there such, because you see what happens when the body field gets all those hormones floating around in it, what it does is it reaches a peak, and it has to reach that peak in order for it to disintegrate. So it's literally a physical arousal state It's a physical arousal that eventually has to disseminate. And that's usually through an act of crisis, and an act of crisis or violence or, you know, something explosive or extreme. But these are things that began with slavery, you see. It began with slavery, and it became part of who we were. But I wanted to kind of begin so you can understand, when I'm talking about the children, I'm not talking about generalities. I'm talking about what's happening to our children that's getting put in the hard wiring that we have got to reverse, or there will be more Rikers Island, because that is where the new economy is. The new economy is there. Now, let me give you another piece to that that became very clear to me. One of the things that I understand has happened, and I've been getting letters from the prisons, so not only is it something that I'm aware of in terms of my own experience, it's something that became confirmed for me as it relates to prison society and prison life. What's happening in prisons is, you all are familiar with the basic socialization process. You are socialized as a result of your environment, your family, whoever's around you. You're socialized in your behavior, how you should act, how you should, all of these things. Imagine three strikes. Imagine mandatory sentencing. Only you're 16. For most of those 16 years, and a lot of the kids in Rikers, by the way, are there because they can't afford the bail. It has very little to do with them being criminals. But they will be certainly criminals when they leave. If they weren't criminals before they got there, they will most certainly be criminals when they leave. And this is why. What is happening in prisons, and this is, I cannot believe that this is not done with some level of deliberate function. Now, let me explain what I mean. Once you get to the point where you are socialized, that means that you're growing up, your critical years of coming to understand rules and limitations. If, in fact, that occurred in a prison, because, you know, there wasn't a lot going on at home. There was a lot of problems, maybe some drugs, maybe some other folks incarcerated. Now Johnny goes to prison at 16, mandatory sentence, three strikes. He's in there for 15 years. So Johnny becomes socialized in prison. So what we consider normal living and growing up and child rearing is occurring in an institution that no longer has schools or trades or the ability to grow oneself. And maybe he doesn't read that well anyway. So then Johnny becomes socialized in the pathology of prison life. And when he's released, he's sent back where? He's sent back to wreak havoc in his community, because he cannot function in a community, can he? The only community he knows to function in is what community? So like a homing pigeon, where is he destined to return? So you see, and they say, but it's not our fault. We didn't do that to him. Of course they did it to him. And the crime is that we let him. So what we have to understand is that this system that is set up, which began very early, it began with convict leash. You've heard me talk about that, because very often those folks that have heard about post-traumatic slave syndrome, when I started to look at it, you know, especially people who want to believe, they can't believe their own barbarism. They cannot believe in the horrific behavior of those civilizing people, those who had the burden of civilizing the backwards and barbaric Indians and Africans, who felt it their responsibility to do so. They cannot believe what they did. There's a book that I recommended. It was very interesting. It's called All God's Children, and Everyone Should Have It. All God's Children by Fox Butterfield. And the interesting thing is, this gentleman is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was responsible for the publication of the Pentagon Papers, and he served as a correspondent for newspapers in Boston, Washington, D.C., New York, all over the place. The man is very renowned. But there wasn't much said about All God's Children. Before I went to Rikers, I asked that they all get a copy of All God's Children. When I arrived, the books were still stacked up in boxes. When I left, they were scrambling to find a copy. But what I understand is there's a gentleman named Willie Boskett. Do you all know about Willie Boskett? You should know about Willie Boskett because Willie Boskett, the Boskett Law, was the individual responsible for the development of juveniles being tried as adults. It's called the Boskett Law. Right here in New York. Willie Boskett. And what's interesting about this book is it tells the story of Willie. And I kind of want to talk about this because Willie had an IQ that was off the chain. Brilliant young man. Sociopath, but brilliant. And what happened with Willie Boskett, and the reason why Fox Butterfield got involved, was because he realized there was something wrong with him. He was bright enough to know, I'm not right. And he says, I cannot do the investigation into my family or into my history, but you can. And when he first met Fox Butterfield, he told him these words, I am only a monster created by the system. And he allowed, at that point, he asked for this gentleman to go back and to study, to find out who he was and where he came from. And when he did so, here is what Fox Butterfield said. When he began to look at the Boskett family, because he went all the way back to the antebellum South, to a place called Bloody Edgefield. That's where he actually traced the Boskett family back to the slave. He found out who the Boskets were, and all of them were quite bright, as a matter of fact. They were all quite brilliant. He said what emerged was not just a portrait of the Boskets, but a new account of the origin and growth of violence in the United States. Violence is not, as many people today presume, a recent problem or a peculiarly urban bane. And in its inception, it had little to do with race or class, with poverty or education, with television, or the fractured family. In short, the most of the usual suspects. Rather, it grew out of a proud, stay with me, it grew out of a proud culture that flourished in the antebellum rural South, a tradition shaped by whites, long before it was adopted and recast by some blacks in reaction to their plight. What this man found out was the origins of the violence that he saw Willie Boskett become. He went back and he traced the white lineage that produced the violence, where people were dueling for honor, cutting off ears and noses and fighting in brawls. It was a common sport in a place called Bloody Edgefield. When you begin to look at what happened to these people, you began to realize that, and even when they began to talk about the slaves, a very different picture emerged. Determining crime rates in antebellum South Carolina is necessarily inexact. Contemporary judges, juries, and sheriffs had limited interest in keeping statistics, but some rough estimates can be made. One careful study of judicial records for the period from 1800 to 1860 found that murder rate in South Carolina, an overwhelmingly rural agrarian area, was four times higher than that in Massachusetts, than the most urban industrial state. This goes against the central theorem of modern criminology, which predicts higher homicide rates in densely populated urban regions where crowding and anonymity break down traditional social ties and values. In South Carolina, for example, prosecutions for all crimes of violence, including assault and rape, as well as murder, made up almost 60% of the court cases. But only 18% in Massachusetts, where the most common criminal acts were theft and public drunkenness. The records also show that the vast majority of people put on trial for violent crimes in antebellum South Carolina were whites. The slaves were thought to be a gentle people. So when you begin to look at violence, who pushed whom first? And when we begin to look at the etiology of violence, it comes from white America. From the moment we were boarded on ships and hoarded into 18 inches of space, that's when the violence began. And it's very important for us to know so that our children can know, because we're beginning to believe the hype. Because you see, now we are perceived as the ones that are violent, that need to be imprisoned and everyone needs to be protected from. Remember that when slavery was over, the majority of those lynchings that occurred, the towns that were burned to the ground, was because of what? The protection of whom in particular? White women. And what was the fear that what was going on with white women? That they were going to be raped and attacked by black men. And if that's not projection, I don't know what is. Because it truly wasn't the white women that were being assaulted, it was black women that were being assaulted. For centuries they were assaulted. Just to kind of give you a picture of what I'm saying when I talk about violence so we don't get confused, let's be clear what happened. One of their favorite sports was a savage form of wrestling, or wrestling, which evolved in Virginia into rough and tumble, and in South Carolina into knockdown and drag out. An Irish traveler, Thomas Ashe, described a fight between a Virginian and a Kentuckian. The contestants were asked if they wanted to fight fair or rough and tumble. When they replied rough and tumble, the crowd roared in approval. The Virginian began by pitching himself into the bosom of his opponent, sinking his sharpened fingernails into the Kentuckian's head. The Virginian never lost his hold, fixing his claws in his hairs and his thumbs in his eyes, and ripped out his opponent's eyes from their sockets. Even after the eyes were gouged out, the fight continued. The Virginian sunk his teeth into the Kentuckian's nose and bit it into two pieces. He then tore off the Kentuckian's ears. Finally, the Kentuckian, deprived of eyes, ears, and nose, gave in. The victor, though maimed and bloodied himself, was carried around the crowds in the grounds by the crowds. These were normal, regular behaviors, and what followed that was dueling, where you insult someone and they basically, you know, have a duel and shoot each other, all for the purpose of honor. Honor. Now, I want you to stay with that, because you have to understand that this became the model for slaves. These were the models for slavery, that one would become violent to protect one's honor. Well, how much honor did slaves have? So you begin to see the superficial and artificial creations of what I soon began to understand was respect. Because you remember what I said happened when my husband and I visited Rikers. What happened with those young men, they couldn't believe it, but I respected them. And that's all that it meant. So let me go back and kind of give you a picture of this so we can move forward. What got me started on a lot of my work around post-traumatic slave syndrome was looking at certain behaviors. One of those behaviors was violence. I had a real interest in violence. Less interest than white people had in it, because most of my white professors really wanted me to look at violence. Wasn't what I wanted to look at. I wanted to look at vacant esteem. That was my desire, to look at what happens to people who have a lessened sense of self. Not low self-esteem, you know, like I can't do as many push-ups or chin-ups as Johnny. I'm talking about the primary esteem that makes you whole as a person. I wanted to know what happens when a person is robbed of their dignity through generations. I also want you to understand what happens to people who are continually malnourished. All of these have impacts on the brain. What happens to people who are continually forbidden to read? How many of you are familiar with the term reading readiness? Okay. What happens is there is a continuum under which human beings develop. I teach a course called Human Development in the Social Environment, Birth to Death, which basically kind of gives you a picture of how we all develop along a continuum. Now, the interesting thing is African Americans always are 3 to 6 months ahead of white children in their development. Now, that's a fact. This is not mythical. Every developmental psychologist, every psychiatrist, every therapist, every occupational therapist, all of them know, but how often have you heard that? So the question becomes, if we start off ahead, how do we end up behind? Okay. So clearly we're not talking about something where we have an incapacity to learn or understand. We start off ahead. My grandson, the doctors go, is he sitting up yet? The boy was walking. Right? So one of the things that I understand about human development has a whole lot to do with what goes on in the environment. So there is actually a readiness neurologically to read. That's why after a certain period, it's much more difficult to learn to read. Now, I want you to stay with me. We have to understand that there are cells that develop that create a readiness to read and retain the information. What happens when you've got 246 years of not being able to? So we have to understand what goes on in the body, all of which is, you know, it's not necessarily genetic, because we obviously have, with each child born, the same process begins again. But what happens when you have that much neglect? And then something called learned helplessness. Learned helplessness. Now, what does that mean? You know, Pavlov and Skinner and all the ones that used to do horrible experiments with animals. You know, now they say it's not okay to do that to animals. They didn't seem to have a problem with them doing it to black people, but they can do it to animals.
212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. So, ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, this is where the rubber meets the road, as they say. And I was just back in the tally room, and we've got this full complement of volunteers. They're all very fired up. They're all enthusiastic. They're all awaiting your calls, and they're ready to go. They're ready to roll. And this is where we're going to have to leave things for the afternoon. We've been sharing with you over the course of the afternoon extended excerpts from Professor Michelle Alexander's talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, discussing her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Professor Michelle Alexander's talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church is available as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $60 level. So too is her book. And by the way, the talk is available on DVD with your pledge at the $60 level. Her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, that's the new revised and updated edition of the book with a new foreword by Professor Cornel West. That is also available as a thank you gift at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD of her talk, Michelle Alexander's book and talk, with your pledge at the $100 level. And then in this final hour of the program, we've been sharing with you excerpts from Dr. Joy DeGruy's lecture, How Are the Children? This is a very powerful lecture. It's been a while since we presented this work. And I was, so much of what Michelle Alexander was saying was so powerfully evocative of so much of what Dr. DeGruy has said, and her research and expertise and her presentation on the impact of post-traumatic slave syndrome and how it manifests itself as a result of the intergenerational transfer of the various pathologies associated with the experience of enslavement over several hundred years. You know, Dr. DeGruy's presentation speaks for itself. It's very powerful, and that lecture, which is part of a workshop that she delivered conducted in Newark, New Jersey, Dr. DeGruy's lecture and the question and answer session that is part of the workshop that she presented in New Jersey, that is available on a double audio CD with your pleasure, the $50 level. The number to call is 212-209-2950. Please join those who are on the line right now, 212-209-2950. A reminder to you, don't panic when you don't hear me tomorrow or the next day. I'm taking a few days off. I've my personal vacation time, but I shall be returning either on the 25th or on the 29th. That's either Thursday of next week or the Monday after that. And I'll be back for the final week of this fall membership and fundraising drive. In the meantime, though, It would be great if you could join those who are on the line right now as we wrap things up this afternoon. I'd like to say thank you very much to George Samuels, who is in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks to Christabel Gallimore, who is in Crisco. Yeah, Mount Crisco, it looks like. Thank you. Mount Kisco. Thank you very much for your support. Thanks also to Wilbert Owens, who is in Brooklyn, New York. And to Sam Rose in Laurelton. That, of course, is in Queens. And to Joan Collymore Jackson, who is also in Brooklyn. And to Ernest Boyd, who is in Wheatley Heights, New York. And to James Wiggins in the Bronx. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks also to, is it David Moore? 212-209-2950. Thanks to Stephen Marotta, who is in... is this Matawan or Matawan, Mr. Haskins?
Matawan.
In Matawan, Stephen Marotta, thank you very much for your support. That, of course, is Matawan is in New Jersey. 212-209-2950. And thanks to all of you who are on the line right now. Thanks to all of you who have already called so far this afternoon. As you know, we rely on your support to keep the lights on and the microphones live here at WBAI. We are a listener-sponsored and commercial-free radio station, and it is your support that keeps us on the air, that makes it possible for us to continue to present the programming that we do. Programs like Talkback, heard Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. And so I thank you very much for that. I also, if you're only now joining us or if you joined us sometime after the beginning of the program, if you were among those who turned out last night in your very enthusiastic numbers at the New York City Society for Ethical Culture for an evening with Chris Hedges, I want to say a special thank you to you for being there and for your very generous and enthusiastic support of the evening's program. Both Chris and I were very, very pleased with the quality of the presentation and the evenings and the response. You were so enthusiastic, and it was really such a wonderful experience interacting with you as listeners and supporters and sharing some of the stories that you shared with us. It was really wonderful, and I don't do these things often. So when I do, it is so important to me that they work well. And last evening's event worked so well, thanks to you, of course, and your support. So thank you, and thank you again. Mr. Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music. Mr. Haskins, we're, 7 minutes away from the WBAI Evening News.
That's right. We're on the home stretch, the last lap, the final lap of the program this afternoon. We're done with the presentations. We were just playing an excerpt from Dr. Joy DeGruy and How Are the Children? Double CD set for a $50 pledge supporting Talkback with Hugh Hamilton. 212-209-2950. We only have a few minutes. We have some announcements to make before the top of the hour, so please make your calls now. 212-209-2950. I have some thank yous when I get to in just a moment. But you know, Hugh, Michelle Alexander and her book is still available, The New Jim Crow, for a $60 contribution.
Yes.
Or the DVD for a $60 contribution. The book CD combination for $100 pledge at 212-209-2950. Pledging using Visa card, MasterCard, American Express, or newly now the Discover card. You can pledge there. Electronic funds transfer. It only takes three and a half minutes to make those pledges. Thank you so much. Join that caller on the line right now. Michelle Alexander was talking about how we had to embrace these people, our people, cousins, brothers, and sons and so forth, when they came back from upstate or wherever they have gone and been incarcerated at. I'm thinking about the Fortune Society.
Absolutely.
And the and the work that David Rothenberg has been doing for decades.
For
here last week with you on this program. And so we want to applaud the work that the Fortune Society is doing and has done, and David Rothenberg and his work.
Oh, absolutely.
And this radio station, because it is only here at WBAI, could something like the Fortune Society even be discussed? And it is discussed. Could we be talking about How Are the Children by Dr. Joy DeGruy, Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow? We talk about that regularly. We have these folks on here regularly because it's our responsibility to do that. It is our responsibility to do that. And we want to thank you so much coming up on the last about 3 minutes of the program at 212-209-2950 for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton.
Indeed, and thank you very much, Michael G. Haskins, Mr. Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer, director of Incidental Music. You also wanted to thank a few of our listeners.
Yes, very quickly, Hugh. I'd like to thank Leon Simmons in the Bronx, Philip Jacobs in Irvington, New Jersey. Let's see, Ms. Jean Angel Campbell in New York. Thank you so much. Leslie Davis in Freeport. Oscar Johnson in Neptune, New Jersey, in the South Jersey. Edgar Seaver from Massapequa Park, New York. Stephen Canty from the Bronx. And from Elizabeth, New Jersey, Eugene Foster calling in and pledging for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton.
Indeed, thank you very much for your support. And I know, Michael G. Haskins, that you've been reminding listeners about the Jammin' in Harlem event coming up on October 20th.
Yes,
Broadway coming to Uptown with a cast of about 20 performing artists, actors, and musicians. Some of the best and brightest stars on Broadway in a not-to-be-missed rollicking review, Jammin' in Harlem. They're coming from all over the country, these wonderful performers, staging two benefit concerts on the same day to raise funds to repair the landmark St. James Presbyterian Church, which is home of the oldest Presbyterian congregation in Harlem. It is 117 years old and counting, and a beloved institution in the African American arts community. The church, by the way, is the birthplace of the world-renowned Harlem School of the Arts. Review, Jammin' in Harlem, taking place on Saturday, October 20th. Grab a pen and write this number down so that you can get more information. There are going to be two shows at 1 p.m. and at 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, this coming Saturday, August 20th, at the St. James Presbyterian Church, 409 West 141st Street. At St. Nicholas Avenue. And all you can call this number, 212-470-9837. That's 212-470-9837 for more information. Or visit jamininharlem.com. That's JAMINHARLEM. Harlem. That's Jammin' Harlem. Not Jammin' In, but Jammin' Harlem. Harlem. JAMINHARLEM. JamminHarlem.com. Okay, folks. This is where I leave it. Thank you very much to our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music, Mr. Michael G. Haskins. Thanks to all of our volunteers. Thanks to our tally coordinator. And above all, thanks to you and you and you and you for making this possible. I am Hugh Hamilton. Find us on Facebook under my name, Hugh Hamilton, and I shall see you again in about a little over a week from now, either on the 25th or on the 29th, when I return from vacation. Thank you so much for your support. See you then. The good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
And this is the music of Tia Fuller. Tia Fuller will be at the Jazz Standard tonight with two sets, 7:30 and at 9:30. Tia Fuller. This is WBAI in New York. We're broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. The evening news is up next.
This is Susan Lee. Did you know that that liberation after the Civil War was a death sentence for hundreds of thousands of freed people? Join me and Jim Downs, author of Sick from Freedom, African-American Illness and Suffering During the Civil War and Reconstruction, to explore this horrendous chapter in American history in a You and Your Money special on Wednesday, October 17th from 3 to 5 p.m. That's Wednesday, October 17th from 3 to 5 p.m.
And we'll see you tomorrow at 3 p.m. That's Susan Lee with a You and Your Money special presentation. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please continue to call as we go into the news hour. The phone lines will still be open and you can still make those pledges on WBAI 4 Talkback with Hugh Hamilton. It's 6 p.m. in New York. Thank you very much. There's another call coming in. It's 6 p.m. in New York. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.
Good evening. In the news tonight, students burdened with education loans want the New York City Council to ban credit checks by potential employers. AIDS activists dressed as prisoners are headed to the site of tonight's presidential debate to draw attention to the criminalization of people with HIV. And the Green Party candidates for president and vice president were detained this afternoon as they tried to enter the hall where the debate will be held. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, October 16th, 2012. Today, students and community activists gathered outside the Borough of Manhattan Community College to call on the City Council to ban credit checks by employers. They say credit checks constitute an unfair barrier for students who are saddled by debt from student loans and are seeking jobs. WBAI's Linda Perry has the story.
In a study done by Rutgers...
Hiya, peeps. I'm Kimberly Massengill. Join me Tuesdays 10 to noon for Thump and Growl. Funk, soul, slowcore, trip-hop, jangle pop, devil twang, indie rock for grown-ups. Draggy, buzzy jazz nobody'd ever mistake for smooth. Less than flattering songs about Jesus. Old school crooners sporting impressive amounts of hair product. The slow, grindy grooves a junky stripper would probably dig. Blues by musicians wearing hats of some sort. Songs sung in languages I don't understand. Good covers of bad songs, bad covers of good songs, and loads more. Thump and Growl with Kimberly Massengill. Tuesdays 10 to noon on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and streaming live at WBAI.org.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Uchasha, akan tu uchasha. Owe to na kechama khakele akan ombi. O ahutopa na khupahu yukhambi. Tako shkanshkan ombi kele na yuha. Ma khakele akan khanka tako ma echa kele na kehe om. O na ha ohoki chila mani pikte. Ma khakele ohoki la mi moshi kele. He om heche. Le om yuta.
Datangi mai eraro ewe kama
Get out. Tarina Ihani washtelo, hiuha chante washtea na page yuzapi yellow, le un kipiki he washtelo, oyate hona umpi uhola oskati wichoni. Greetings and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart, and the whole world is a beautiful morning. It's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully and celebrate life in addition to reality. From the Pacifica Radio Network, this is First Voices Indigenous Radio coming from your radio station, and that is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. I send you greetings and strength from the East Gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. Our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org, also WBAI.org if you're live streaming it. And I want to thank you for last week, your generosity, as always, and for being there. You know who you are, and we cannot continue without you and you, the listeners. On this day, October 11th in 1869, the Red River Rebellion, or Red River Resistance, began. It was a sequence of events related to the 1869 establishment of a provisional government by the Métis leader Louis Riel and his followers at the Red River Settlement in what is now the Canadian province of Manitoba. The Canadian government had bought Rupert's land from the Hudson's Bay Company in 1869 and appointed an English-speaking governor, William McDougall. He was opposed by the French-speaking, mostly Métis inhabitants of the settlement, and before the land was officially transferred to Canada, McDougall sent out surveyors to plot the land according to the square township system used in Ontario. The Métis, led by Riel, prevented McDougall from entering the territory. In 1870, the legislature passed the Manitoba Act, allowing the Red River Settlement to enter a confederation as the province of Manitoba, we say. And the act of also incorporated some of Riel's demands, such as provision of separate French schools for Métis children and protection of the practice of Catholicism. Also on this day in 1878, Kiowa war chief Satanta jumped to his death from a prison hospital window in Huntsville, Texas. One of the best known of the Kiowa war chiefs, he developed a reputation as an outstanding warrior, and in his 20s was made a sub-chief of his tribe. Under Dehoshan, as chief, Satanta was captured after the Battle of Adobe Walls, which he